Now you just don't want to shave yours, crows Swarthrop. Ha ha, some witch. I'll show you something, she says, which is why they are now awake at this ungodly hour, side by side, holding hands, very still as the sun begins to clear the horizon. Now watch, Gailey whispers, out there. As the sunlight strikes their backs, coming in nearly flat on, it begins developing on the pearl cloud bank. Two gigantic shadows, thrown miles overland, past Klaus-Tau-Zelterfeld, past Zazen and Goslar, across where the river Leine would be, and reaching toward Weser. By golly, Swarthrop, a little bit nervous, it's the specter. You got it up around Greylock in the Berkshires, too. Around these parts it is known as the Brockengespenst, God shadows. Swarthrop raises an arm. His fingers are cities. His biceps is a province. Of course he raises an arm. Isn't it expected of him? The arm shadow trails rainbows behind as it moves, reaching eastward for a grab at Göttingen. Not ordinary shadows, either. Three-dimensional ones, cast out on the German dawn. Yes, and Titans had to live in these mountains or under them. Impossibly out of scale, never to be carried by a river. Never to look to a horizon and think that it might go on forever. No trees to climb, no long journeys to take. Only their deep images are left, haloed shells lying prone above the fogs men move in. Daly kicks a leg out straight as a dancer and tilts her head to the side. Swarthrop raises his middle finger to the west, the headlong finger darkening 3 miles of cloud per second. Daly grabs for Swarthrop's cock. Swarthrop leans to bite Daly's tit. They are enormous, dancing the floor of the whole visible sky. He reaches underneath her dress. She twines a leg around one of his. The spectra wash red to indigo, tidal, immense, at all their edges. Under the clouds out there, it's as still and lost as Atlantis. But the Brockengespenst phenomenon is confined to dawn's slender interface, and soon the shadows have come shrinking back to their owners. Say, did that Cicerini ever... Cicerini is too busy for this. Oh, and I'm some kind of a drone or something. You're different. Well, he ought to see it. She looks at him curiously but doesn't ask why. Her teeth halt on her lower lip, and the varum, varum, a plastic man sound, hovers trapped in her mouth. Just as well. Swarthrop doesn't know why. He's no help to anybody who's fixing to interrogate. Last night he and Gailey blundered onto a Schwarzkommando picket outside one of the old mine entrances. The Hereros threw questions at him for an hour. Oh, just wondering about, you know, looking for a bit of the odd, what we call human interest, fascinating. Of course, we're always interested in what you chaps are up to. Gailey snickering in the darkness. They must have known her. They didn't ask her anything. When he brought it up later, she wasn't sure just what this is between Cicerini and the Africans, but whatever it is, it's being carried on with high passion. It's hate, all right, she said. Stupid, stupid. The war's over. It isn't politics or fuck your buddy. It's old-time, pure personal hate. Anthean? I think so. They found the Brocken, occupied both by American and by Russian troops. The mountain lay on what was to be the border of the Soviet zone of occupation. The brick and stucco ruins of the radio transmitter and a tourist hotel loomed up just outside the firelight. Only a couple of platoons here, nobody higher than non-coms. The officers were all down in Bad Harzburg, Halberstadt, someplace comfortable, getting drunk or laid. There is a certain air of resentment up on the Brocken, all right, but the boys like Gailey and tolerate Swarthrop, and luckiest of all, nobody seems to be connected with that ordnance. It's only a moment's safety, though. Major Marvey is gnashing about the hearts, sending thousands of canaries into cardiac episodes, dropping in yellow droves belly up out of the trees as he marauds on by hollering, "Git, that limey sucker. I don't care how many men it takes, I want a fucking division, you hear me, boy? Only a matter of time before he picks up the trail again. He's out of his mind." Slothrop's a little daffy, but not like this. This is really unhealthy, this Marvey persecution. Is it possible? Yep, the thought has certainly occurred to him that Marvey's in tight with those Rolls-Roycers who were after him in Zurich. There may be no limit to their connections. Marvey is buddies with GE, that's Morgan money. There's Morgan money in Harvard and surely an interlock someplace with Lyle Bland. Who are they, hey? Why do they want Swarthrop? He knows now for sure that Zwitter, the mad Nazi scientist, is one of them. And that kindly old Professor Glimpf was only waiting down in the Mittelwerke to pick up Swarthrop if he showed. Jesus. If Slothrop hadn't snuck out after dark back down into Nordhausen to Gailey's place, they'd have him locked up by now for sure, maybe beaten up, maybe dead. Before they head back down the mountain, they manage to chisel 6 cigarettes and some K-rations off of the sentries. Gailey knows a friend of a friend who stays out on a farm in the Golden Hour, a ballooning enthusiast named Schnorp, who is heading toward Berlin.
But I don't want to go to Berlin.
You want to go where Marvy isn't, Liebchen. Schnorp is beaming, eager enough for company, just back from a local PX with an armload of flat white boxes, merchandise he plans to move in Berlin. No trouble, he tells Slothrop. Don't worry, I've done this trip hundreds of times. Nobody bothers a balloon. He takes Slothrop out in back of the house, and here in the middle of a sloping green field is a wicker gondola beside a great heap of bright yellow and scarlet silk. Real unobtrusive getaway, Slothrop mutters. A gang of kids have appeared running out of an apple orchard to help them carry 10 jerry cans of grain alcohol out to the gondola. All shadows are being thrown uphill by the afternoon sun. Wind blows from the west. Slothrop gives Schnorp a light from his Zippo to get the burner going while kids straighten out the folds in the gas bag. Schnorp turns up the flame till it's shooting sideways and with a steady roar into the opening of the great silk bag. Children visible through the gap break up into wiggly heat waves. Slowly the balloon begins to expand.
Remember me, Gailey calls above the rumbling of the burner, till I see you again.
Slothrop climbs in the gondola with Schnorp. The balloon rises a little off the ground and is caught by the wind. They start to move. Gailey and the kids have taken hold of the gondola all around its gunwales, the bag still not all the way up but gathering speed, dragging them all as fast as their feet can move, giggling and cheering uphill. Slothrop keeps as much out of the way as he can, letting Schnorp see that the flames pointed into the bag and that lines to the basket are clear. At last, the bag swings vertical across the sun, the inside of it going a riotous wreathing of yellow and scarlet heat. One by one, the ground crew fall away, waving goodbye. The last to go is Gailey in her white dress, hair brushed back over her ears into pigtails, her soft chin and mouth and big, serious eyes looking into Slothrop's for as long as she can before she has to let go. She kneels in the grass, blows a kiss. Slothrop feels his heart, out of control, inflate with love, and rise quick as a balloon. It is taking him longer, the longer he's in the zone, to remember to say, "Aw, quit being a sap." What is this place doing to his brain? They soar up over a stand of firs. Gailey and the children go dwindling to shadow strokes on the green lawn. The hills fall away, flatten out. Soon, looking back, Slothrop can see Nordhausen, Cathedral, Rathaus, Church of St. Blasius, the roofless quarter where he found Gailey. Schnorp nudges and points. After a while, Slothrop makes out a convoy of 4 olive-drab vehicles dusting along toward the farm in a hurry. Marvy's mother's, by the looks of things. And Slothrop hanging from this gaudy beach ball. Well, all right. "I'm bad luck," Slothrop hollers over a little later. They've found a steady course now northeastward and are huddling close to the alcohol flame, collars turned up. With a gradient of must be 50 degrees between the wind at their backs and the warmth in front. "I should have mentioned that. You don't even know me, and here we're flying into that Russian zone." Schnorp, his hair blown like holidays of hay, does a wistful German thing with his upper lip. "There are no zones," he says, which is also a line of Gailey's. "No zones, but the zone." Before too long, Slothrop has begun checking out these boxes here that Schnorp brought along. There are a dozen of them, and each contains a deep golden custard pie, which will fetch a fantastic price in Berlin. "Wow," cries Slothrop. "Holy shit, surely I hallucinate," and other such eager junior sidekick talk. "You ought to have a PX card," the sales pitch. "Right now I can't afford a ration stamp for an aunt's jockstrap," replies Slothrop forthrightly. "Well, I'll split this one pie here with you," Schnorp reckons after a time, "because I'm getting kind of hungry. Oh, boy, oh, boy." Well, Slothrop is just chowing on that pie, enjoying himself, licking custard off his hands, when he happens to notice off in the sky, back toward Nordhausen, this funny dark object the size of a dot. Schnorp looks around. "Cut!" comes up with a brass telescope and braces it, blazing on the gunwale. "Cut! Cut! No markings. I wonder..." Out of air so blue you can take it between your fingers, rub and bring them back blue, they watch the dot slowly grow into a rusty old reconnaissance plane.
Presently, they can hear its engine, snarling and sputtering. Then, as they watch, it banks and starts a pass. Along the wind between them, faintly, comes the singing of furies. There was a young man named McGuire who was fond of the pitch amplifier, but a number of shorts left him covered with warts and set half the bedroom on fire. Yeah, 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 yeah. In Prussia, they never eat pussy. The plane buzzes by a yard or two away, showing its underbelly. It is a monster about to give birth. Out of a little access opening peers a red face in leather helmet and goggles. You limey sucker, going past. We fixin' to hand your ass to you. Without planning to, Slothrop has picked up a pie. Fuck you, he flings it. Perfect shot. The plane peeling slowly past, and blop gets Marvy right in the face. Yeah, gloved hands, paw at the mess. The major's pink tongue appears. Custard drips into the wind. Yellow droplets fall in long arcs toward Earth. The hatch closes as the recon plane slides away, slow rolls, circles, and heads back. Schnorp and Slothrop heft pies and wait. There's no cowling around that engine, Schnorp has noticed, so we'll aim for that. Now they can see the dorsal side of the plane, its cockpit jammed to capacity with beer-sodden Americans singing, There once was a fellow named Ritter who slept with a guidance transmitter. It shriveled his cock, which fell off in his sock and made him exceedingly bitter. 100 yards and closing fast. Schnorp grabs Slothrop's arm and points off to starboard. Providence has contrived to put in their way a big white slope of cloud, and the wind is bringing them swiftly into it. The seething critter puts out white tentacles, beckoning, hurry, hurry, and they are inside then, inside its wet and icy reprieve. Now they'll wait. No, Schnorp cupping an ear. They've cut the motor. They're in here with us. The swaddled silence goes on for a minute or two, but sure enough, there once was a fellow named Schroeder who buggered the vain servo motor. He soon grew a prong on the end of his schlong and hired himself a promoter. Schnorp is fiddling with the flame, a rose-gray nimbus, trying for less visibility but not too much loss of altitude. They float in their own one sphere of light without coordinates. Outcrops of granite smash blindly upward like fists into the cloud, trying to find the balloon. The plane is somewhere with its own course and speed. There is no action the balloon can take. Binary decisions have lost meaning in here. The cloud presses in, suffocating. It condenses in fat drops on top of the pies. Suddenly, raucous and hungover, there was a young man from Decatur who slept with a LOX generator. His balls and his prick froze solid real quick, and his asshole a little bit later. Curtains of vapor drift back to reveal the Americans, volplaning along well inside 10 meters and only a little faster than the balloon. Now! Schnorp yells, heaving a pie at the exposed engine. Slothrop's misses and splatters all over the windscreen in front of the pilot, by which time Schnorp has commenced flinging ballast bags at the engine, leaving one stuck between two of the cylinders. The Americans, by surprise, reach in confusion for sidearms, grenades, machine guns, whatever it is your ordnance types carry around in the way of light armament. But they have glided on past, and now the fog closes in again. There are a few shots. Shit, man, if they hit that bag... Shh, I think we got the wire from the booster magneto. Off in the middle of the cloud can be heard the nagging whicker of an engine refusing to start. Linkage squeaks desperately. Oh, fuck! A muffled scream far away. The intermittent whining grows fainter until there is silence. Schnorp is lying on his back, slurping pie, laughing bitterly. Half of his inventory has been thrown away, and Slothrop feels a little guilty. No, no, stop worrying. This is like the very earliest days of the mercantile system. We're back to that again, a second chance. Passages are long and hazardous. Loss in transit is a part of life. You have had a glimpse of the Urmacht. When the clouds fall away a few minutes later, they find themselves floating quietly under the sun. Shrouds dripping, gas bags still shiny with the moist cloud. No sign at all of Marvy's plane. Schnorp adjusts the flame. They begin to rise. Toward sundown, Schnorp gets thoughtful. Look, you can see the edge of it. At this latitude, the Earth's shadow races across Germany at 650 miles an hour, the speed of a jet aircraft. The cloud sheet has broken up into little fog blankets the color of boiled shrimp. The balloon goes drifting over countryside whose green patchwork the twilight is now urging toward black. The thread of a little river flaming in the late sun, the intricate angled pattern of another roofless town. The sunset is red and yellow, like the balloon. On the horizon, the mild sphere goes warping down, a peach on a china plate. The farther south you go, Schnorp continues, the faster the shadow sweeps till you reach the equator, 1,000 miles an hour. Fantastic. It breaks through the speed of sound somewhere over southern France, around the latitude of Carcassonne. The wind is bundling them on, north by east. Southern France, Slothrop remembers then. Yeah, that's where I broke through the speed of sound. The zone is in full summer. Souls are found quiescent behind the pieces of wall, fast asleep down curled in shell craters, out screwing under the culverts with gray shirt tails hoisted, adrift dreaming in the middles of fields. Dreaming of food, oblivion, alternate histories. The silences here are retreats of sound, like the retreat of the surf before a tidal wave. Sound draining away down slopes of acoustic passage to gather someplace else to a great surge of noise. Cows, big lummoxes splotched black and white, harnessed now for the plowing because German horses in the zone are all but extinct, will drudge with straight faces right on into minefields, sown back in the winter. The god-awful blasts go drumming over the farmland. Horns, hide, and hamburger come showering down all over the place. The dented bells lie quiet in the clover. Horses might have known to keep clear, but the Germans wasted their horses, squandered the race, herding them into the worst of it, the swarms of steel, the rheumatic marshes, the unblanketed winter chills of our late fronts. A few might have found safety with the Russians who still care for horses. You hear them often in the evenings. Their campfires send up rays for miles from behind the stands of beech, through northern summer haze that's almost dry, only enough of it to give a knife's edge to the firelight. A dozen accordions and concertinas all going at once in shaggy chords with a reed ringing to it, and the songs full of plaintive stiez and sneeze with the voices of the girl auxiliaries clearest of all. The horses whicker and move in the rustling grass. The men and women are kind, resourceful, fanatical. They are the most joyous of the zone's survivors. In and out of all the vibrant flesh moves the mad scavenger, Chicherinje, who is more metal than anything else. Steel teeth wink as he talks. Under his pompadour is a silver plate. Gold wirework threads and three-dimensional tattoo among the fine wreckage of cartilage and bone inside his right knee joint, the shape of it always felt, Payne's hand-fashioned seal, and his proudest battle decoration, because it is invisible and only he can feel it. A 4-hour operation, and in the dark, it was the Eastern Front. There were no sulfur drugs, no anesthesia. Of course he's proud. He has marched here with his limp as permanent as gold, out of coldness, meadows. Officially, he reports to TSAGI, which is the Central Aero and Hydrodynamics Institute in Moscow. His orders mention technical intelligence, but his real mission in the zone is private, obsessive, and not, so his superiors have let him know in a number of delicate ways, in the people's interest. Chicherinje guesses that this, taken literally, may be true enough, but he is not sure about the interests of those who warned him. They could have their own reasons for wanting Enzian liquidated in spite of what they say. Their differences with Chicherinje may be over the timing or the motives. Chicherinje's motives are not political. His building in a German vacuum ended on a compulsive need he has given up trying to understand. A need to annihilate the Schwarzkommando and his mythical half-brother Enzian. He comes from nihilist stock. There are in his ancestry any bonds. He is no relation to the Chicherinje who dealt a treaty with Walter Rathenau. There was a long-term operator, a Menshevik turned exile, and his return, believe them all, were somewhere in his seat. There's an end sleep and arms that have opened maniacally to death, faithful network of Fräuleins around the zone, even when the intelligence hazards of love, of attachment, are still light when balanced against what he has to do. Nation can sweat in the winter, sticky tea glasses, and step to pit. It was a land of drunk the cities, silent, truly speech, gesture, touch among Mexico as the red jorts. Young smear chokmans were almost as strange to the Russian cadre. Tall prince thought of it this way. Representee A, new Turkic alphabet, uncommonly alien country. Chicherinje will usually mosey down to the red jort there to look in on that gal who appeals to what must be a kid or two in his personality. Well, he'll come outside to find his moon skies full of sheet lighting, glaring, awful. Except that it is a fairly average day for pulse after heaven-wide above the sweeping desyatinas of grasses, of mullein stalks, rippling out of sight, in the street, out in it, hitching his paddles, whipped, rattling against his chest, army pioneer. He will not come to love this sky or plain, these people, their animals. And in the worst marsh bivouacs of his soul, in naked Leningrad and Kath, of the deaths of comrades, never keep any memory of seven rivers, no, against the step. Already she is more like the shape of a procedure for field stripping, back trigger with four as your bolt with right, locking precautions, part of a prop, Duba Chicherinye, working out its changes, its little dialectic, until it ends, with nothing, the structure. Her eyes hide in ice, orbits darkened as is small, square, bird forward, the lower teeth more apt to show when she, for a smile, bones strongly curved and welded. Her aura is chalk dust, laundry soap. With desperate Luba about the edge of the room at her window, a pretty hawk, a Luba who flows the first long dive, the talon shock in the blood while her lean low in the at white words. Light pulses behind the clouds. Chichi street into the sir gets a blush from Luba, a kind of cowmical Chinese swamper chupia, stares from an early pupil or two. Native school teacher, Jackin, up from a crisps, black theodolites, bootlaces, tractor gaskets, plugs, greasy ends, steel, 7.62 millimeter round, Yoshka, about to ask for a cigarette which is already out of Chicherinye's and en route. He'd better. He's not Chicherinye's, much less the Russian's friendship. Ulan's father was killed during the 1960s, trying to get away from one of about 100 fleeing Kyrgyz massacred one evening peaceable somehow north to the zero at the top of the world. Russians settled the darker refugees, pitchforks, old rifles, any weapon to hand. A common occurrence in Semyuritsy. Then, even that from the Antetachs, Kyrgyz, and Dungans, that tilt game. Daily scores were kept. It was a competition, good-natured, but more than play. Thousands of wrestlers bit the dust. There was even their numbers lost forever. Colors of skin became reason jail. Even speeches, because rumors of German agents swept along these plains, not without help from Petrograd. This native uprising was supposed to be the doing of an international conspiracy to open a new front war. More Western paria, based solidly on the European Balerbi, Kazakh, Kyrgyz, Easterns. Hadn't the nationalities been happy? Hadn't 50 years of Russian rule brought progress? Well, for now, under the current dispensation in Moscow, Jakub Kulan is the son of a national martyr. The Tsar, power in Russia, ancient and absolute, kind to the nationalities. But though the lovable tyrant does what he can, he's as much a native as before, gauged day to day by these Russians as to his degree of restlessness. His sorrow face, his long narrow eyes, and the lonely hide tents out there among the resistances. Use him that is. Except look from Luba suggesting falconhood. Here, shes of seven rivers have not yet been alphabetized and perhaps never will be. They are at any time to come into a room, into a heart, returning all Soviet alternatives brought out here by the Likbez agents. T.A. cannot fit, frightening as the elements in this bear's corner, while some so pitiless. She had to come out here to learn what an earthquake felt like and how to wait out a sandstorm. What would it be to a city? Often she will dream some dainty pasteboard model, a city planner's city, perfectly detailed, out neighborhoods. At the same time, she is also down inside, looking up, waiting at the blows from the sky, drawn to whatever it is approaching, knowing, awful to say, it is herself, her central giant self, aimless thing she fears. These all, these stormy, he is constant by westward, the African half-brother and his poetry books furrowed and settering burnt wood black, waiting by one out across the unnumbered versts of lowland and of slants as their autumns come around again, leans along the planet's withers like an old circus rider, tries to catch their attention with nothing more than its public face, and continues to fail at each perfect pass around the ring. but didn't now and then, not often, across the paper schoolroom or by surprise in front of windows into the green deep open, give Chichen the look, say, nothing you do, nothing he does will help you in your mortality? And farther apart, why let it matter this much? Live, die someday, honorably, meanly, but not by... The life keeps bringing the same free advice, each time a little less hopefully. But neither brother can listen. The black must have found his own version of some native to German dreams of the tenth elegy angel coming, wing beats all edges of waking, coming to trample spoorless the white of his facing east, the black face keeping winter embankment or earth-colored wall of a grange, Poland awaiting, just as Chinya grows each month now smooth at his westward flank, seeing history and geopolitics move them surely into confrontation as the radios go screaming higher, new paths in the night to the touch with hydro age, mounting across the empty canyons and passes, skies in the day go thick, miles of falling canopies, white visions of rich men's heavenly jorts, gaining now and still awkward, but grow, each strewn pattern less and less at play. Out into the bones of the backlands ride Chichirinya and his faithful Kyrgyz companion Jakip Kulan. Chichirinya's horse is a version of himself, an Appaloosa from the United States, Snake. Snake used to be some kind of remittance horse, being sent a check each, or if you enjoy paranoid systems, a horribly rational man to stay off of the U.S. rodeo circuits, where in those days the famous bucking bronco Midnight was flung men right and left into the sun-beat fences. But Snake here, not Night Wild, methodically homicidal, were unpredictable. When you go to ride him, he may be in docile as a maiden. And again, with no warning, seized at last ruffling of a great sigh, he could kill you simply as the jerk of a tuck of a head toward the exact moment and spot on the ground that you'll cease to live. No way to... For months he can be no trouble at all. So far he's ignored. But he's tried for Jakip Kulan 3 times. Dumb luck preserved. The 3rd time he actually hung on and rode the colt a long time down to a fair kind of obedience. But each time King Picket on the hillside, he carries, with his leather gear and his bit of horse's back, the doubt, the inconsolable chance Kigis didn't really break him last time, that Snake is only waiting away from road. Farther over, black and white stars explode down the Appaloosa's croup and haunch. At the center of each of these novae is a stark circle of vacuum, of no color, into which midday Kyrgyz at the roadside have taken looks and grinned away with a turn of the head to the horizon behind. Strain the dynamics of oil and the ways. Snake has seen a lot of changes since Arabia, en route to Chichirinya, who may be his other half. Lot of horse thieves, hard riding, confiscation by this government and that, escapes into ever more remote country. This time, sound of hooves, birds big as turkeys, black and white with splashes of blood red all around the eyes, lumbering for the uplands, Snake is going out into what could be the lure of all. Hardly remembering now the water pipes, the oases crawling with smoke, the bearded and barbed naked light up into Caucasian foothills in the dark, carried by lust, by storm along street trail, only terminal grasslands. Shadows damping into wet forests on the night slowly disappears. Waiting out in yet is the for them, the unimagined creature of Owen dust with her buttocks arched skyward. First touch of him, spine, rock. Yuba simply meaning Chichirinya, and but out to the wildest, and carrying on quiet expression under some official curse. The rumors are as extravagant as this country is listless. In the room the corporals talk about a woman, an amazing woman who wore camisoles of whited and shaved her perfect legs every morning all the groin. It's fucking Catherine, earned and brilliant, brought up to date. Her lovers ran from ministers down to the likes of Captain Chich, naturally her truest. While Neopotemkins ranged the deep Arctic, her skilled and technocratic wolves erecting settlements out of tundra, entire urban abstractions out of ice and snow, bold Chichirinya was back at the capital, snuggled away in her dacha, where they played at fisherman and fish, terrorist and state, explorer and edge of the wave-green world. When official attention was finally directed their way, it did not mean death for Chicherinya, not even exile, but a thinning out of career possibilities. That happened to be how the vectors ran in those days. Central Asia, for a good or attaché someplace like Costa Rica, where he wishes it could be Costa Rica someday, a release from this shuff. How he misses the sea, how he dreams of eyes dark and liquid as his own, colonial eyes, gazing down from balconies of rotting stone. Meanwhile, another rumor tells of his connection with the legendary Wimpe, the head sail arts IG. Because it is that IG representative abroad on German spies, reporting back to an office in Berlin known as U7. This story about Chicherinya is not so easy to believe. If it were literal, you would. There's no possible way his life could have been spared in favor of this somnambulism among the eastern garrison towns. Certainly he could have known him for a while, ran man in the clock of enthusiasm. Charming, handsome in shelves or terraces of strength, amiable gray eyes, vertical granite quivered, chin incapable of fat. Dark suits, immaculate silver studs, horsehide gleamed under the skylights in the Tsarist entrance halls and across the Soviet concrete, his specialty and in suggested faith. Think of chess in his early days around the capital, looking for a comparison that Russians might take to, an extravagant game of chess, going on to show if his audience was receptive and reflexes, new to steer automatically along lines of least in how each molecule had so many possibilities. Possibilities for bonding, bonds of different strength, the most the queen, the great Catherine of the periodic table, down to the little hydrogens and position of the chessboard game to dance figures in three dimensions, four if you like, and a radically different idea of what winning and losing meant. Schwärmerei, his home had muttered, by excuses to driven patience. But Chicherinya would have stayed. Foolish, he would have kept listening and egged the German on. How could they have failed? By and by, the affair in its repressed and bloodless way, the Soviet chain of command, solicitous as any 19th century family, would begin to take some part. Conservatory, Central Asia, but in soft intelligence, before the watchers quite caught the heads angling inside the dark pockets of that index. Since his earliest detail man, expertise had been focused in cyclized benzyl isocyanates, those of major interest being the opium alkaloid and the riot. Rooms of office, a suite at an older hotel, full of samples. German in amazing profile for his face to come, a 2% solution of morphine. Dionine. We add on an ethyl group here to the morphine as use. Halopan and neopan, all mixtures of opium alkaloids as the soluble hydrochloride and phosphates. Here is eucodal, a codeine with tins, a hydroxyl, a hydride. Gesturing in the air around his basic fist, hanging off different parts of the moccasins, trappings and detailing were half the game. As the French do with their dresses, nicht wir a pretty buckle, there to help sell a sparer design. Ah, this, trivaline. One of the jewels of his line. Morphine and caffeine and cocaine all in as the valerates. Valerian, yeah. Root and rye. You may have older relatives who took the nerve test. Mentory, you might say. Some trimming over these bare molecules. What did Chicherinya have to say? Was Chicherinya there at all? Sitting back in the dingy room while the lift cables slapped and creaked through the walls? And down in the street, rarely enough to matter, a droshky rattled whip-snapping over these black old cobbles? Or while snow beat at the grimy window. How far, in the eyes of those who would send him to Central Asia, was too far? Would his simple presence in these rooms have given him death automatically, or was there still even at let him reply? But once the pain has been taken care of, the simple dear I have heard, he heard, not the subtlest way to get into it, I must have known every standard opener there is. Some military men are only blunt of holding back. They will lead the charge themselves. It's magnificent, but it's not. Wait until the Eastern Front, his first action, will develop and has a military sangage et puis envoi. And as for plunging ahead, well, that IG and hotel room may have been one of his earlier rehearsals. Chicherinya has a way of getting together with undesirables, sub-rosa, counter-revolutionary odds and ends of humanity. He did plan it any given time. And in the drift of things, in the dance of things, howsoever, others latch on and the pharmacology of the Chicherinia thus modified, its onwardly revealed side effects can't necessarily be calculated ahead of time. Chupiam, the Chinese factotum in the red jurt, knows something of this. The first day Chicherinia came to report in to the place, Chupiang knew, and tripped over his mop, not so much to divert attention as to celebrate the meeting. Chupiang has a bond, or tea is a living monument to the success of British trade policy back during the last century. This classic hustle is still famous even today for the cold purity of its execution. Bring opium from India, introduce it into China. Howdy, Fang. This here's opium. Opium. This is Fang. Ah, so, me eaty. No, ho, ho, Fang, you smoky, smoky, see? Pretty soon Fang's coming back for more and more, so you create an inelastic demand for the shit, get China to make it illegal, then sucker China into a couple, three disastrous wars over the right of your merchants to sell opium, which by now you are describing as sacred. End of side 11. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 12. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Fincham. Continuing on page 403. You win, China loses. Fantastic. Chupiang being a monument to all this, nowadays whole tourist caravans come through to look at him. Usually while he's under the influence. Here, ladies and gentlemen, as you may have observed, the characteristic sooty gray complexion. They all stand peering into his dream-struck facies, attentive men with mutton-chop sideburns holding pearl-gray morning hats in their hands, the women lifting their skirts away from where horrid Asian critters are seething microscopically across the old floorboards, while their tour leader indicates items of interest with his metal pointer, an instrument remarkably thin, thinner than a rapier, in fact, often flashing along much faster than eyes can really follow. His need, you will notice, retains its shape under all manner of stresses. No bodily illness, no scarcity of supply seems to affect it a whit, all their mild, their shallow eyes following gently as piano chords from a suburban parlor. The inelastic need turns luminous this stagnant air. It is an ingot beyond price, from which sovereigns yet may be struck, and faces of great administrators engraved and run off to signify. It was worth the trip just to see this shining, worth the long passage by sleigh over the frozen steppe in an enormous closed sleigh, big as a ferry boat, bedizened all over with Victorian gingerbread. Inside are decks and levels for each class of passenger, velvet saloons, well-stocked galleys, a young Dr. Maledetto, whom the ladies love, an elegant menu including everything, from millefeuille à la fondue de la cervelle to la surprise du vésive. Loungers amply fitted out with stereopticons and a library of slides, oak toilets, rubbed to a deep red and hand-carved into mermaid faces, acanthus leaves, afternoon and garden shapes to remind the sitter of home when he needs it most, hot insides poised here so terribly above the breakneck passage of crystalline ice and snow, which may be seen also from the observation deck, the passing vistas of horizontal pallor, the wheeling snowfields of Asia beneath skies of metal baser by far than this we have come to watch. Chupiang is also watching them as they come, and stare, and go. They are figures in dreams. They amuse him. They belong to the opium. They never come if it's anything else. He tries not to smoke the hashish out here, actually, any more than courtesy demands. That chunky, resinous Turkestan phantasmagoric is fine for Russian, Kyrgyz, and other barbaric tastes. But give Chu the tears of the poppy any time. The dreams are better. Not so geometrical, so apt to turn everything, the air, the sky, to Persian rugs. Chu prefers situations, journeys, comedy. Finding the same appetite in Chicherinia, this stocky Latin-eyed emissary from Moscow, this Soviet remittance man, is enough to make anybody trip over his mop. Suds hissing along the floor and the bucket gong crashing in astonishment, in delight. Before long, these two wretched delinquents are skulking out to the edges of town to meet. It is a local scandal. chew from some recess within the filthy rags and shreds that hang from his unwholesome yellow body, produces a repulsive black gob of the foul-smelling substance, wrapped in a scrap torn from an old Enbekshi Kazakh for 17 August of last year. Chicherinya brings the pipe. Being from the West, he's in charge of the technology of the thing, a charred, nasty little implement in red and yellow repetitions over Britannia metal, bought used for a handful of kopecks in the leper's quarter of Bukhara, and, yes, nicely broken in, too, by that time. Reckless Captain Chicherinya, the two opiomaniacs crouch behind a bit of wall wrecked and tilted from the last earthquake. Occasional riders pass by, some noting them and some not, but all in silence. Stars overhead crowd the sky. Far into the country grasses blow and the waves move on through, slow as sheep. It's a mild wind, carrying the last smoke of the day, the odors of herds and jasmine, of standing water, settling dust. A wind Chicherinya will never remember, any more than he can now connect this raw jumble of 40 alkaloids with the cut, faceted, polished, and foiled molecules that salesman Wimpe showed him once upon a time, one by one, and told the histories of. Onirene and methonirene, variations reported by Laszlo Jampf in the ACS journal year before last. Jampf was on loan again, this time as a chemist, to the Americans, whose National Research Council had begun a massive program to explore the morphine molecule and its possibilities. A 10-year plan, coinciding, most oddly, with the classic study of large molecules being carried on by Carruthers of DuPont, the great synthesist. Connection? Of course there's one, but we don't talk about it. NRC is synthesizing new molecules every day, most of them from pieces of the morphine molecule. DuPont is stringing together groups such as amides into long chains. The two programs seem to be complementary, don't they? The American vice of modular repetition, combined with what is perhaps our basic search to find something that can kill intense pain without causing addiction. Results have not been encouraging. We seem up against a dilemma built into nature, much like the Heisenberg situation. There is nearly complete parallelism between analgesia and addiction. The more pain it takes away, the more we desire it. It appears we can't have one property without the other, any more than a particle physicist can specify position without suffering an uncertainty as to the particle's velocity. I could have told you that, but why? Why, my dear Captain, why? The money, Wimpe, to pour funds down the latrine on such a hopeless search. A man-to-man touch, then, on his buttoned epaulet. A middle-aged smile full of Weltschmerz. Trade-off, Chicherinya, whispers the salesman. A question of balancing priorities. Research people come cheap enough, and even an IG may be allowed to dream, to hope against hope. Think of what it would mean to find such a drug. To abolish pain rationally without the extra cost of addiction. A surplus cost. Surely there is something in Marx and Engels, soothed the customer. To cover this, a demand like addiction having nothing to do with real pain, real economic needs, unrelated to production or labor. We need fewer of these unknowns, not more. We know how to produce real pain. Wars, obviously. Machines in the factories, industrial accidents, automobiles built to be unsafe, poisons in food, water, and even air. These are quantities tied directly to the economy. We know them, and we can control them. But addiction? What do we know of that? Fog and phantoms. No two experts will even agree on how to define the word. Compulsion? Who is not compelled? Tolerance? Dependence, what do they mean? All we have are the thousand dim academic theories. A rational economy cannot depend on psychological quirks. We could not plan. What premonition has begun to throb in Chicherinya's right knee? What direct conversion between pain and gold? Are you really this evil, or is it just an act? Are you really trafficking in pain? Doctors traffic in pain, and no one would dream of criticizing their noble calling. Yet let the Verbindungsmann but reach for the latch on his case, and you all start to scream and run. Well, you won't find many addicts among us. The medical profession is full of them. But we salesmen believe in real pain, real deliverance. We are knights in the service of that ideal. It must all be real for the purposes of our market. Otherwise my employer and our little chemical cartel is the model for the very structure of nations, becomes lost in illusion and dream, and one day vanishes into chaos. Your own employer as well. My employer is the Soviet state. Yes, Wimpy did say, is the model, not will be. Surprising they could have got this far, if indeed they did, being of such different persuasions and all. Wimpy, however, being far more cynical, would have been able to admit more of the truth before starting to feel uncomfortable. His patience with Chechenya's Red Army version of economics may have been wide enough. They did part amiably. Wimpy was reassigned to the United States. Chemnico of New York, shortly after Hitler became chancellor. Chechenya's connection, according to the garrison gossip, ceased then forever. But these are rumors. Their chronology can't be trusted. Contradictions creep in. Perfect for passing a winter in Central Asia if you happen not to be Chechenya. If you are Chechenya, though, well, that puts you in more of a peculiar position, doesn't it? You have to get through the winter on nothing but paranoid suspicions about why you're here. It's because of Ensign. It's got to be damned Ensign. Chechenya has been to the Krasny Archiv, has seen the records, the diaries and logs from the epical doomed voyage of Admiral Rozhdestvensky, some still classified even after 20 years. And now he knows. And if it's all in the archives, then they know too. Nubile young ladies and German dope salesmen are reason enough to send a man east in any period of history, but they would not be who or where they are without a touch of Dante to their notions of reprisal. Simple Italian may be fine for wartime, but politics between wars demands symmetry and a more elegant idea of justice, even to the point of masquerading a bit decadently as mercy. It is more complicated than mass execution, more difficult and less satisfying, but there are arrangements Chechenya can't see, wide as Europe, perhaps as the world, that can't be disturbed very much between wars. It seems that in December 1904, Admiral Rozhdestvensky, commanding a fleet of 42 Russian men-of-war, steamed into the southwest African port of Lüderitzbucht. This was at the height of the Russo-Japanese War. Rozhdestvensky was en route to the Pacific to relieve the other Russian fleet, which had been bottled up for months in Port Arthur by the Japanese. Out of the Baltic, around Europe and Africa, bound across the whole Indian Ocean and then north along the final coast of Asia, it was to be among the most spectacular sea voyages of history, 7 months and 18,000 miles to an early summer day in the waters between Japan and Korea, where one Admiral Togo, who'd been lying in wait, would come sailing out from behind the island of Tsushima and before nightfall hand Rozhdestvensky's ass to him. Only 4 Russian ships would make it into Vladivostok. Nearly all the rest would be sunk by the wily Jap. Chechenya's father was a gunner on the admiral's flagship, the Suvorov. The fleet paused in Lüderitzbucht for a week, trying to take on coal. Storms lashed through the crowded little harbor. The Suvorov kept smashing up against her colliers, tearing holes in the sides, wrecking many of her own 12-pound guns. Squalls blew in, clammy coal dust swirled and stuck to everything, human and steel. Sailors worked around the clock with searchlights set up on deck at night, hauling coal sacks, half blind in the glare, shoveling, sweating, coughing, bitching. Some went crazy. A few tried suicide. Old Chechenya, after 2 days of it, went AWOL and stayed away till it was over. He found a Herero girl who'd lost her husband in the uprising against the Germans. It was nothing he had planned or even dreamed about before going ashore. What did he know of Africa? He had a wife back in St. Petersburg and a child hardly able to roll over. Up till then, Kronstadt was the farthest he'd been from home. He only wanted a rest from the working parties, and from the way it looked, from what the black and white of coal and arc light were about to say, no color, and the unreality to go with it, but a familiar unreality that warns, this is all being staged to see what I'll do so I mustn't make one wrong move. On the last day of his life, with Japanese iron whistling down on him from ships that are too far off in the haze for him even to see, he will think of the slowly carbonizing faces of men he thought he knew, men turning to coal, ancient coal that glistened, each crystal, in the hoarse sputter of the Yablochkov candles, each flake struck perfect, a conspiracy of carbon. Though he never phrased it as carbon, it was power he walked away from, the feeling of too much meaningless power, flowing wrong. He could smell death in it. So he waited till the master-at-arms turned to light a cigarette and then just walked away. They were all too black, artificially black, for it to be easily noticed, and found ashore the honest blackness of the solemn Herrero girl, which seemed to him a breath of life after long confinement, and stayed with her at the edge of the flat, sorrowful little town near the railroad in a one-room house built of saplings, packing cases, reeds, mud. The rain blew. The trains cried and puffed. The man and woman stayed in bed and drank curry, which is brewed from potatoes, peas, and sugar, and in Herrero means the drink of death. It was nearly Christmas, and he gave her a medal he had won in some gunnery exercise long ago in the Baltic. By the time he left, they had learned each other's names and a few words in their respective languages, afraid, happy, sleep, love. The beginnings of a new tongue, a pidgin, which they were perhaps the only two speakers of in the world. But he went back. His future was with the Baltic fleet. It was something neither he nor the girl questioned. The storm blew out. Fog covered the sea. Tcherenya steamed away, shut back down in a dark and stinking compartment, below the Suvorov's waterline, drinking his Christmas vodka and yearning about his good times in a space that didn't rock. Back at the edge of the dry veldt with something warm and kind around his penis besides his lonely fist. He was already describing her as a sultry native wench. It is the oldest sea story. As he told it, he was no longer Tcherenya, but a single-faced crowd before and after, all lost, but not all unlucky. The girl may have stood on some promontory watching the gray ironclads dissolve one by one in the South Atlantic mist, but even if you'd like a few bars of Madame Butterfly about here, she was more probably out hustling. Or asleep. She was not going to have an easy time. Tcherenya had left her with a child, born a few months after the gunner went down in sight of the steep cliffs and green forests of Tsushima, early in the evening of 27 May. The Germans recorded the birth and the father's name. He had written it down for her as sailors do. He had given her his name. In their central files at Windhoek. A travel pass was issued for mother and child to return to her tribal village shortly after. A census by the colonial government to see how many natives they'd killed, taken just after Entin was returned by bushmen to the same village, lists the mother as deceased, but her name is in the records. A visa dated December 1926 for Entin to enter Germany, and later an application for German citizenship are both on file in Berlin. It took no small amount of legwork to assemble all these pieces of paper. Tcherenya had nothing to start with but a brief word or two in the Admiralty papers. But this was in the era of Fyodora Alexandrievna, she of the kidskin underwear, and the access situation was a little better for Tcherenya than it is now. The Rapallo Treaty was also in force, so there were any number of lines open to Berlin. That weird piece of paper, in his moments of sickest personal grandeur, it is quite clear to him how his own namesake and the murdered Jew put together an elaborate piece of theater at Rapallo, and that the real and only purpose was to reveal to Vaslav Tcherenya the existence of Entsium. The garrison life out east, like certain drugs, makes these things amazingly clear. But alas, seems like the obsessive is his own undoing. The dossier that Tcherenya put together on Entsium, he'd even got to see what Soviet intelligence had on then-Lieutenant Weissmann and his political adventures in Sudvest, was reproduced by some eager apparatchik and stashed in Tcherenya's own dossier. And so it transpired, no more than a month or two later, that somebody equally anonymous had cut Chicherny's orders for Baku, and he was grimly off to attend the first plenary session of the VCKNTA. Sesoyuzny Centralny Komitet Novogo Tukskogo Alfavita, where he was promptly assigned to the GIE committee. GIE seems to be a kind of G, a voiced uvular plosive. The distinction between it and your ordinary G is one Chicherny will never learn to appreciate. Come to find out, all the weird letter assignments have been reserved for ne'er-do-wells like himself. Shatsk, the notorious Leningrad nose fetishist, who carries a black satin handkerchief to party congresses and, yes, more than once has been unable to refrain from reaching out and actually stroking the noses of powerful officials, is here, banished to the F committee, where he keeps forgetting that F in the NPA is Fe, not Russian F, thus retarding progress and sowing confusion at every working session. Most of his time is taken up with trying to hustle himself a transfer to the N committee. Or actually, sidling closer, breathing heavily, just a plain N or even an M will do. The impetuous and unstable practical joker, Radnichny, has pulled the Schwa committee, Schwa being a Schwa, or neutral where he has set out on a megalomaniac project to replace every spoken word vowel in Central Asia. And why stop there? Why not even a consonant or two? With these Schwas here, not unusual considering his record of impersonations and dummy resolutions, and a brilliant but doomed conspiracy to hit Stalin in the face with a grape chiffon pie, in which he was implicated only enough to get him Baku instead of worse. Naturally, Chicherny gravitates into this crew of irredeemables. Before long, if it isn't some scheme of Radnichny's to infiltrate an oil field and disguise a derrick as a giant penis, it's lurking down in Arab quarters of the city, waiting for the infamous Ukrainian doper Vugnogorkov of the glottal K committee, ordinary K being represented by Q, whereas C is pronounced with a sort of ch sound for a hashish connection, or fending off the nasal advances of Shatsk. It occurs to him that he is, in reality, locked up in some military nut ward back in Moscow and only hallucinating this plenary session. No one here seems quite right in the head. Most distressing of all is the power struggle he has somehow been suckered into with one Igor Blobadjan, a party representative on the prestigious G committee. Blobadjan is fanatically attempting to steal Gies from Chicherny's committee and change them to G's, using loan words as an entering wedge. In the sunlit, sweltering commissary, the two men sneer at each other across trays of zapyakanka and Georgian fruit soup. There is a crisis over which kind of G to use in the word stenography. There is a lot of emotional attachment to the word around here. Chicherny one morning finds all the pencils in his conference room have mysteriously vanished. In revenge, he and Radnichny sneak in Blobadjan's conference room next night with hacksaws, files, and torches, and reform the alphabet on his typewriter. It is some fun in the morning. Blobadjan runs around in a prolonged screaming fit. Chicherny's in-conference meetings called to order crash. 24 linguists and bureaucrats go toppling over on their ass. Noise echoes for a full 2 minutes. Chicherny, on his ass, notes that pieces of chair leg all around the table have been sawed off, reattached with wax and varnished over again. A professional job, all right. Could Radnichny be a double agent? The time for light-hearted practical jokes is past. Chicherny must go it alone, painstakingly by mid-watch lantern light. When the manipulations of letters are most apt to produce other kinds of illumination, Chicherny transliterates the opening surah of the Holy Quran into the proposed NDA and causes it to be circulated among the Arabists at the session over the name of Igor Blobadjan. This is asking for trouble, all right. These Arabists are truly a frenzied bunch. They have been lobbying passionately for a new Turkic alphabet made up of Arabic letters. There are fistfights in the hallways with unreconstructed Cyrillicists and whispers of a campaign to boycott throughout the Islamic world any Latin alphabet. Actually, nobody is really too keen on a Cyrillic NPA. Old Tsarist albatrosses still hang around the Soviet neck. There is strong native resistance in Central Asia these days to anything suggesting Russification, and that goes even for the look of a printed language. The objections to an Arabic alphabet have to do with the absence of vowel symbols and no strict one-to-one relation between sounds and characters. So this has left Latin by default. But the Arabists aren't giving up. They keep proposing reformed Arabic scripts, mostly on the model of one ratified at Bukhara in 1923 and used successfully among the Uzbeks. Palatal and velar vocalics of spoken Kazakh can be got round by using diacritical marks, and there is a strong religious angle in all this.